So what won't be there that begins with D? Doctors. Yeah, it's right. It's right. The leaves of the trees will be for the healing of the nations. Thank you. What else? D? Death. Disease. Darkness. Disorder. Despair. Disobedience. Dentist. Same thing. Yeah. Doom and disaster and any number of... Yeah, good. Okay, D is a good letter. Any other letters we think are good? S is a good letter. Okay, what starts with S that won't be there? Whoa, one at a time. Sin, sorcerers, sickness, the sea, and because the sea won't be there, no surfing, no sand, no, yeah, that's right. Good, keep going, what else do we have? No sun, no serpent, no Satan, shame, sickness, did we say all that? Yeah, good, so there's some whole list of things that won't be there. That's what we're going to, that's where we're going to. Let's just have a, kind of the picture. So this is what we're going to draw. So if you haven't left enough space on your piece of paper to draw that, you're already busted. This is kind of, this is point six of the last talk, really. Okay, so just showing you what we're doing, we have the outside that is the two bits in blue. Okay, Genesis 1 and 2, Revelation 21 and 22. You don't need to draw all this now, just to give you a feel for where we're going. And then the red is the prototype. Okay, the red is the prototype. We're going to have a prototype rescue, and we're going to get all it ready. And then the green is the real rescue. The green is when we're going to have the real rescue done. And then the yellow bit, you've begun hearing in the sketch some sort of why is it taking so long? Why are they so slow? We're going to keep thinking that because after the rescue, we're then going to have some waiting. When we are rescued, but we're not rescued. The now and the not yet rescued. Until we finally get back into the outside and the real rescue. Does that make sense? That's where we're heading. So roughly the Old Testament is the red bit there. The red bit there where we're going to build the prototype. Okay, turn back to page 8. We can click off that slide. Next slide on and we'll just show you where we are on the drawing. So we did Abraham. We got up to Moses and Joshua. We say with Abraham we've got one man chosen to build a prototype new creation. God's people, a nation descended from Abraham, as many as the sand on the shore. God's place, the land of Canaan, roughly where Israel is today, and in relationship with God, blessing for all the nations. And as we're going through the Old Testament, anything you read, more or less, fits into one of those three categories. Which bit are we building? So the stuff about babies, which one does that fit into? People. And there's loads about babies. Can't have babies. You have too many babies. There's babies that are being killed. People. If you get stuff about wells or cities, what's that about? Place. Yeah? So, and battles and fighting, often that's about place. We're working our way through to the rescue of the world and a crusher of Satan. And we've seen God answering those promises. So we've seen with people, promises have been answered. We've seen with place. Promise have been answered. So we're doing okay on the Bible quiz. Let's just click till we see the Bible quiz. One more, I think. There's people and again place. Okay, so what about relationship? That was your homework during coffee. Where did you reckon, let's have a few answers, where do you reckon the relationship comes true? Exodus when? 40. When God comes and lives in the tabernacle. Good answer. What else do we think? Anyone have a different answer? Exodus 20, when the commandments, thank you. Or Exodus 19, when they go and meet God, thank you. Any other guesses? Yeah, so maybe just X's all the way through, because you're going to go to the new question. Good. Okay, so I think it's the real drama, the relationships, the most important bits, and it is in every single one of these books. For instance, Exodus. Okay, you think we did Exodus, don't you? We think we dealt with it. Do you remember? We said there are plagues, there is let my people go, there is Passover, there is the Red Sea, the people on their way to the land. But I don't know if you know Exodus well. If you do, you'll notice that all of that just covers the first 15 chapters. So all the bits you've ever heard of, all the bits you ever did in Sunday school, gets us up to about chapter 15 in a 40-chapter book. Because the book of Exodus really is about relationship. So let's click. I think we'll get a kind of heading. There we go. So Exodus starts with Moses on Mount Sinai meeting God, in the burning bush. And Moses is told to go and get God's people, the new nation of Israel, and bring them out of Egypt and bring them to Sinai to meet their gods. So Exodus 3, verse 12. Let's start at the back now. So who should we start with at the back? Can we start with Vijay at the back? Exodus 3, verse 12.
It says, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you. And I have sent you, and you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain."
Thank you. Serve, worship, same word. And every time in that verse where it says you, it means Moses, it's singular, until the final one is you, plural. You will serve God on this mountain. These people are going to come here and begin a relationship. Worship, serve, relationship, word with a ruler. So Exodus is actually a journey to meet their gods. It's a journey to meet their God. It's not very smooth, but they get there. And so Exodus 19 is the high point. They arrive at Sinai, and instead of a burning bush, they have a burning mountain. And their relationship begins. They're back in the presence of God. So can we have 19 verses 4 to 6, read by our next person? Do you hear it? He has brought them to myself, to be my treasured possession. It's relational. Or 20 verse 2. Next person will be 20 verse 2. I am the Lord your God. I'm the Lord your God. Rescued from Egypt for a relationship with God. It's still a relationship with a ruler. So there are still rules, just like in the garden. So 19 verse 5, if you obey my voice, that's where the Ten Commandments fit in. And they are about relationship retention, those commandments. If you obey, then you'll be. But they are also part of God's good blessing. So 20 verse 2, I rescued you. Then at once, verse 3, the Ten Commandments. And we just need to notice the order those things happen in. It has never been the deal with God that an enemy of God could keep enough of God's rules until they could become his people. Never been possible to earn the relationship with God. That wasn't true in the Old Testament. It's not true now. The people of Israel, they are already his people before they even hear the Ten Commandments, before they even know what they are. And they're only his people because God has stomped all over Egypt, kicked sand in Pharaoh's face, and brought them on eagle's wings to meet him and be his treasure possession. And only then do they hear the Ten Commandments. And because he is a good God, his rules are part of his blessings. He's with them to protect them, to bless them, and to tell them what to do. That's part of the blessing. And his rules are good for them, so good for them. They're things like don't murder each other, don't steal, don't lie to each other, stay faithful in relationships. They're so good, the nations around are supposed to stare in amazement and say, who is your God? Because these rules are so good. Again, do you remember our aim? Maybe I didn't say this. Our aim is that we could put you down blindfolded anywhere in the Bible and you'd be able to work out where you were and where we're going and what's going on. So law, lots of those first few books is law. What's that all about? It's about relationship. You're in relationship. This is part of the blessing and being one of God's people. Okay, so far so good on relationship. Do you want to tick the box at that point? Well, again, as we heard, if you've read Genesis, this isn't quite walking in the garden. And you'll know if you know Exodus that there's a lot more stuff to come. In fact, after some Ten Commandment-like stuff, we get a lot of stuff about a tent. A lot of stuff about a tent. We basically get pages after pages of camping instructions for a very big tent, often called the tabernacle. So flick on to chapter 25. And here is God's promise about that tent. Could the next person read us 25, verse 8 and verse 9? Thank you. So these are camping instructions, but God is the one going camping. Okay, this is God is going camping. It's so that I will dwell among them. So I will be in their midst. Okay, so there's the relationship of Eden that we're trying to build our way back to. And a tent is good because it means God can go with them. God can be in their midst wherever they go. So if we click again on the drawing, that is supposed to be a drawing of a tent, and you put it in there. And we think, you know, what a business. Why don't they just have God living inside them by his Spirit like we do? And the reason is, it is very scary to have a relationship with a God of absolute holiness if you are a sinner. So can the next person, can you read Exodus 20, 18 and 19? Thanks, Lizzie. So they are terrified of God. They come out of Egypt to meet God on the mountain, and they're terrified of him, and they are right. The repeated message through Exodus to Deuteronomy is that there is danger in knowing God. Being in a relationship with God is dangerous. And I think we're so used to being forgiven, we're so bored of it, that we forget that. So chapter 19, don't come near the mountain, or it will kill you to meet God. If a sinful person comes face to face with God, then they will die because God is their eternal judge. And God isn't just a sort of bored paper pusher about sin. There's another one. There's another sin. God feels passionately. So, for example, because he cares for his people, he is furious with Pharaoh for abusing them and hurting them. So you read the papers, the way that I feel about a rape or a murder, God feels infinitely deeply, and he cares about those people because he made them. He's the owner of the person that is hurt. So to walk into God's presence with sin is to walk in as a declared traitor or rebel. Genesis 3, I want to be God's. I want to overthrow him and kill him. And every single lie or angry thought is just another small signal that I'm still continuing that revolt. Okay, so they're given a relationship with God, the tabernacle, but they're terrified. They fear God and they're right to. Because even while Moses is on the mountain getting the instructions about the tent, Exodus 32, what they do is they gather together all of their gold and they make an image of a golden calf. And they worship that and they say, that is the God that brought us out of Egypt. Which commandments is that they've broken? Commandment number one and commandment number two. And so the promises are under threats. Okay, should we just practice that? Promises are under threat! Okay, that's much better. Because they've rebelled against God, and God says that he is going to destroy them, which means there will be no people and no rescue of the world. So we have a basic problem. How is it that sinners can be in a relationship with God? And the answer is grace. I think click and we'll get the next set of headings. The answer is grace. The answer is God will need to be generous and give freely what is not deserved. So has anyone done Exodus in their quiet times? Tried to do a kind of chapter a day of Exodus? And did anyone notice that the camping section, the tent building section, is repeated? So you kind of read through and the plagues are exciting and get to the mountains and law, and then you get these kind of knitting instructions for a tent, and you press through for a week and off you, I've done it, golden calf, and then you turn the page and it all happens again. You get day after day after day of the exact same knitting instructions. It's repeated once before the rebellion, seven chapters, and also once after. And I went to hear the chief rabbi speak on this once, the last chief rabbi. And I was with a group of quite liberal Christians who hated the chief rabbi because he taught from the Bible and explained it pretty well, and they were not used to that. But then he got to explaining that. Why does it come twice, the camping instructions? And he said, it's because to create a nation, you need to give them something to do. Which is, I think, almost exactly the opposite of the point. What is it that they do What they do is they build a golden calf and they worship a false god and they deserve to be destroyed. What does God do? He says, despite the fact that I offered you a relationship and you threw it away, I'm going to forgive you. And you know what? We will do it after all. Chapter after chapter after chapter. I am going to come and live with you. Why? Because of what God is like, because of his nature. So Exodus 34, and can we have verses 6 to 7 read by the next person? Thank you. So God cares about sin, but as well as caring about sin, he is merciful and gracious. It's what we're learning about God throughout this, aren't we? Why did he create you? Because he loves you and wants to be in a relationship with you. Why won't he give up on you? Because he is merciful and gracious. Why are we heading up to a positive ending rather than crashing down out of sin? Because he is merciful and gracious, because that's what God is like. So God stays with them, and at the end of the book, Exodus 40, verse 34. Next person, please. So they build this tent, and God fills it and comes to live with them. But we should still feel very, very nervous about how this relationship is going to go in the future. In fact, next person, read verse 35. Okay, do you see? God's come to live in the tent. It's called the tent of meeting. There's a clue in the name about what it's for. But once the glory of God is in there, even Moses can't go in. We can't go in because we're too sinful. Exodus ends on that puzzle. How can sinful people get to meet God? And the very next thing that happens, can we have Leviticus 1, verses 1 and 2, please? So there's the tent, God's in the tent, they can't go in because of sin, and then God speaks from inside the tent to Moses outside and begins to talk about offering animals, killing animals. So sin leads to death, we know that from the diagram, sin leads to us crashing out, but then Leviticus 17 verse 11, next person, tells us why animals have blood. Vets here, you think you know why? Because of circulation and stuff like that, but Leviticus 17 verse 11 tells us why animals have blood. Thank you. Atonement, the word there is covering over. And the blood is there to cover over your sin. Sin leads to death, so only a death will do. And here in the prototype, it is the death of animals. And Leviticus is not a book for vegetarians, basically. Okay, it is page after page after page of blood and dead goats and dead bulls and dead chickens and sizzling fat, and you wave bits of cow in the air and you flick blood at people everywhere, and we leave the room dripping with blood and whole buckets of blood, because to keep sinful people in relationship with God, you have to deal with their sin, and they keep sinning. So you have to keep dealing with their sin. And the sort of high point of it is in Leviticus 16. On the annual Day of Atonement, when they offer up, well, you'll see. So on the handout and on the slide, I think, in groups, can you look at some of those verses? Again, we'll split them up around the room. 1, 2, 3, 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Just have a look at your verses. What happens and how do you feel as an Israelite? Go. Okay, and pause then. It is, it's quite gruesome, isn't it? Quite gruesome stuff when you actually try and imagine it. I've looked at it with kids groups before, and I normally bring a couple of cuddly toys, you know, two little fluffy rabbits, and a really big kitchen knife. Okay, and then you get them to act it out, and it's astonishing how children look innocent until you give them a really big knife. And you say, we need Bunny's head to come off. because up it comes. I'm not sure it's very health and safety, but there you go. So do you see what happens to sin? Some teachers in the room looking horrified. See what happens to sin in the chapter. Sin needs to be transferred. I have to get it away from me, otherwise I am in terrible trouble. And we have two goats that it gets transferred to, and one of them gets the punishment for my sin. That goat gets killed, and its blood goes inside the tabernacle to the very heart, to the place where God dwells, and there is a death for my sin. And the blood is given for covering my sin. But the other goat gets to carry my sins. And that goat takes them on his back and carries them miles and miles and miles away into the wilderness. Not to be free. If you had those verses, I hope you noticed, it's not kind of happy goat off to play in the wilderness. And the wilderness is where the lions are, where the desert is the death. It's bye-bye sins, and I feel free. Did you get there with how the Israelites would feel watching this? I am clean. For another year, my relationship with God can go on. And that feels great. But again, if you've been reading all the way from Genesis, maybe we might not be sure how good this is. So God is with his people, but we have to not look at them when they come out, do we? They're drying their hands. They've got lovely dry hands. It's a good thing. Good. Back on the temple. Okay, we're there. God is with his people, isn't he? But God is in a tent. And only the high priest is allowed to go into that tent. And the offerings they need doing so often, because there is so much sin. And actually, God's people have said, we don't want to speak directly to God. We only want to speak through Moses. Do you see, sin is still an enormous part of this relationship. And we said, didn't we? We're going to try and work out what this prototype is for. What's it for? This is a sin prototype. That's the Formula One car is about speed. This prototype is about sin. That's what it's for. You should notice actually how much of the Bible is about sin. Christianity is actually all about sin. It's about a rescue from sin. It's about coping with ongoing sin in our world. It's about understanding what we're like with sin. If you think that Christianity is basically about something else, then actually you've misunderstood lots of the Bible. Again, it's not popular to talk about sin. People often just leave that out in their explanation of Christianity. I, at the age of 10, was horrified when somebody said to me, Christianity is all about sin, and you're a sinner, and you need to be forgiven. I'd been in church thousands of times by that point, 2,000 times by the time I was 10. And I hadn't got the idea that Christianity is basically about sin and forgiving sinners. And actually, through the early books of the Bible, you can see us sort of focusing in on a few individuals who, because of sin, they have to stand in between God and his people. I'm going to call them sort of sin technicians. And you can ask people, you can ask your colleagues this, ask yourself this, what do you think is wrong with the world? And what sort of technician do you need to stand in the way? So if you think what is basically lacking in the world is not enough education, then what do you need, sin technician? Or technician, rescuer, you need a teacher. Educate the world and the world's problems will be solved. If you think what's wrong with the world is it needs charity, well then you need a social worker. That's the technician that will save the world. If you think what we need is capital and finance, then your sin technician, your rescuer, is a banker or someone like that. Depends what you think is wrong with the world. Well, next slide. What is it that's going to make this relationship work? Can we just see the next slide? There we go. Okay, so what would make this relationship work? There is a relationship. There are arrows between the people and God, but we need different people to go in the way. So next one. It's gone away. There we go. We need a high priest, Leviticus 16. We need somebody to make sacrifices because of the guilt we need. We've also said the people need Moses to speak to God for them. So click again. We need a prophet. Turn to Deuteronomy 18. Remember, the contents page is your friend if you need him. And Deuteronomy 18. Moses says, we're looking ahead to a new prophet. So can we just have someone read verse 16 in Deuteronomy 18? Thank you. They said, don't let me talk to God. You do it for me. They were right to say that. The answer was a prophet, Moses. And the future answer is a prophet like Moses in the future. Verse 18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. And prophets, you see, are not first of all about telling the future. It's kind of fortune telling. First of all, they're about relationship with God. They're about communication with God because of sin. It's hard to hear from God. It's hard to speak to God because we're sinful. So we have a prophet in the way. So Moses does that. But at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses dies. And we have a problem, 34 verse 10, as the book ends. There has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. So now we're looking for a crusher. We're looking for a new Moses. We're looking for a decent high priest. And then the third area this happens in is leadership. I think, click once more. There we go. So the people are unable to stop sinning. They're too sinful. And very quickly, the Bible is pointing towards a king as the answer. And again, in our day, I think probably we sort of despise politicians, don't we? And we look down on them. That is mainly because most of us, depends what country you're from, we have forgotten what political instability actually looks like. We've forgotten what a good thing leadership is. So Judges is the first book of what happens in the Promised Land. And every time there's a problem, it's answered with leadership. We need a judge. And it starts okay at the beginning. Things look all right at the beginning. But there's enough of the old inhabitants left, and Israel begins to behave just like them. And we learn that temporary leaders aren't good enough. So just flick on towards the end of Judges, 17 verse 6, 18 verse 1, 21 verse 25, says, in those days there was no king in Israel. What did that mean? It meant everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And Judges 17 to 21, those are the bits they never let you read in Sunday school. And they are truly grisly, horrendous stories. That is what it is like when everybody tries to do their own thing. We have cowardice, we have gang rape, we have mass killings, and we have near genocide. One whole tribe in Israel is nearly wiped out. What does that mean? Yeah. And if the people are wiped out, we're going to not be able to fulfill the promises. So we need a king. Judges end saying, we need a king, we need a king. And the book of Ruth is a sort of bridge book that introduces us just to one family. And we have one more genealogy. Remember, the excitement is all in the genealogies. End of the book of Ruth. We look for a great-grandson of Ruth, whose name is David. Last word in the book of Ruth. So we're heading towards, next slide, kings in the book, or in the prototype kingdom. And we know that God always planned it that way. And Deuteronomy 17, we're told the king is only good if he rules underneath God. He's not meant to rule instead of God. That is the Genesis 3 mistake. And that is what is wrong the first time the people ask Samuel, the last judge, for a king. So 1 Samuel 8, verse 7, God says, they've not rebelled against you, Samuel. They've rebelled against me. So God gives them a king, like the one they're asking for. He gives them the king Saul, who is big and he is strong. But when it comes to the crunch, 1 Samuel 15, he doesn't do what God says. So God rejects him. And actually, even while Saul is still on the throne, God chooses a shepherd boy called David. Says, I want you to be anointed king instead. And Saul is not too chuffed about that, as you can imagine. But after years and years of hardship, David becomes king. And David is a great king. He defeats all the enemies, from Goliath all the way through to every ite and every stein in the Bible. And for the first time, Israel has rest and is secure. Again, if you imagine the map of the Middle East, you put David, well, he's not even in Jerusalem at the beginning, but then he just pushes all of his life, pushes, and the boundary gets wider and wider and wider. So it's from the river to the Euphrates. And at that point, God makes a new set of promises, a new covenant with David. So just turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. I think it says on your notes we're going to do it in groups. I think for sake of time we're not. 2 Samuel 7. And could somebody, who's the next person? Could you read as loud as you can, chapter 7, verses 10 to 16.
And I will appoint a place for my people Israel. I will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and disturb no more. The violent men will afflict them no more as formerly. From the time that I appointed Gideon over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring next to you, who shall come from your mother, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the God of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. For my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took him from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure for heaven before you. Your throne shall be established forever.
Thank you. And again, here's what I mean by it sort of narrows in each time, the promise. And now we're narrowing in onto the king. What's he promised? A permanent rest for the people, P. The people of Israel, that's verse 10, in their own place, verse 10, where they will have rest, verse 11. Rest is another word for relationship, actually. Security, blessing. But as well as that, he's promised a house for David. And that is, and that's verse 11, that's kind of house as in the house of Windsor. Promised a royal line. And verse 12, did you hear? An offspring. And that offspring, well, it's a little bit confusing, but verse 13, he is going to rule forever. He's going to be a son to God. Verse 14, his throne, verse 16, David's throne will be established forever. And that son, verse 13, he will build a house for my name. There's a kind of double joke going on there, that God's going to build you a house and your son is going to build me a house. And in the first instance, that is exactly what Solomon, David's son, does. So next slide. And we have Solomon, the great climax of the prototype. So, there we go. That's good. Like that. So turn to 1 Kings for a celebration. 1 Kings, the next book after 2 Samuel. 1 Kings chapter 4, and next person read us verse 20. How many people? As many as the sand by the sea, and they're happy. So tick, big tick by people. Okay, there is place. We're not going to read all of them, but just skim down. Verse 21, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines, and the border of Egypt. And we get a sense of how glorious it is. Look at just what he ate in one day. Not him on his own, I think, but his court, and how great it was. Because, verse 24, he's an emperor. Dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him. There is rest. And relationship is there in the verses. Security and wealth. And all the blessings of God. But one more improvement in the relationship, if you weren't quite ready to tick relationship yet, because instead of a tent, Solomon builds a house, a temple. So turn to 1 Kings 8, and just let's put it on the drawing, one more click, and one more, and that is a drawing of a temple. Okay? There at the top of the drawing. And could somebody read us 1 Kings 8, verses 6 to 11?
Brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord, which is placed in the sanctuary of the tent, on the most
Thank you. Sound familiar? And we take the Ark of the Covenant out of the tabernacle, we put it in the temple, and a cloud fills it. God is with us, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. God is with his people. We have a permanent house in a secure city. We have a place to do the sacrifices. We have people, place, and relationship. We followed that kind of theme all the way through, one shape, through the Bible. And look, we have built a fully working model. If you looked at it from space, you could see the temple, see the altar, see the table, see the animals, see the priests moving around. We build a fully working model. And if we worry this isn't exactly like Eden, well, Solomon is so glorious that we just put it aside and enjoy the party, which is what they have in chapter 8. And I want to pause there just at the sort of climax of the prototype and drive this home. Just like our first session, I don't want this to be just knowledge. I want this to be real and believed and lived. So driving it home on the faithfulness of God. So the easiest and safest way to apply anything in the Old Testament through to our day is to remember that God is the same. And we may not be, which is why we may or may not be able to eat shellfish, but God is the same. And if you track the nearly 1,000 years back from 1 Kings 8 back to Abraham, just look at Abraham, one man with no children and no prospect of children, and all he's got is a few promises from God. Then you track it forward 1,000 years and you look at Solomon, the emperor of the Middle East, with his people as numerous as the sand on the sea, and his temple and his safety and security. You have to say, there is pretty amazing faithfulness of God. Over such a long period of time, through so much rebellion. Do you remember Joshua 21? Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All had come to pass. Or 1 Kings 8, can we read next person, verse 20 and 21?
Now the Lord has fulfilled the promise that he made. For I have risen in the place of David my father, and sit on the throne of Israel, as the Lord promised, and I have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I have dwelt in the place of the ark,
Now the Lord has fulfilled his promise that he made. And we've traveled those 1,000 years. It's all come true. And then here's the point. We have the same God. The God you know is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He's the same one. Isn't that an amazing thing to follow and know that God? His promises, we have promises too from him. I will forgive you. I will be with you always. I will bring you to a land, a new creation, heaven. What do you think? After all that we've seen, do you think this God is going to let one promise slip? You might want to make a kind of comparative list of the promises Abraham had and how stupid and ridiculous they looked, and the promises that you have. And just try and say, which one is the harder list? Which one seems more difficult? And the New Testament uses lots of the people that we've seen on our diagram as lessons in faith. Abraham was nearly 90. He had no children. And he believed. Will you believe God's promises? Moses was on his own against the superpower of the day, up against Egypt. And he believed. Are you going to? Joshua, against the mighty armies and cities of Canaan. And he believed. Will you believe? Because their God is your God. And not one of the promises has slipped. And we're also warned, aren't we? We're warned not to be like the generation in the book of Numbers. They watched the plagues and the Red Sea. They met God at Sinai. And they learned nothing. When they got to the promised land and the very next test, the next promise, they didn't believe it, and they all died in the desert. And we want to learn from the 4,000 years of history we're going to do to trust God. God's promises always come true. He is the same. I want to suggest that we pause there. I've got some more things to say. Just pause, turn to your neighbor, and just pray at that point. thanking God that his promises come true. And just do that for a couple of minutes. Okay, maybe to make that the last prayer, if you would. So that would be a very encouraging place to finish the talk, wouldn't it? That would be a really encouraging, happy place to end. But we're not going to. We're going to do point... Don't panic, we're not going to do point 8. We are going to do point 6 and point 7. Point 6, very briefly. The prototype always has a best before date, a shelf life date built into it. And particularly that's clear in the book of Deuteronomy. So the book of Deuteronomy, the book before they even get into the land, is actually a book about exile. It's a book about how they're going to mess it up. It's kind of full of the expectation, we're going to put you in the land, and you are going to break it. It is going to go wrong, and then here is what we're going to do afterwards. So it's a bit like giving a 17-year-old keys to a Ferrari, say, go on, you go and enjoy yourself, here's your Ferrari, while at the same time giving them a kind of book of what to do once you've crashed it, and how to ring your lawyer in jail. And even in Deuteronomy, there's a kind of little song to sing once you're in jail for dangerous driving. Kind of remember how much we went into exile. It's that kind of, it's because the whole book is about it is all going to go wrong. So we're aiming for the top of the diagram, but this is only the prototype. And so what we actually get is a ski jump. So just click. This is very topical, Winter Olympics. There it is. See, the problem of sin is not solved. And the whole thing comes crashing down because sin is a constant pull downwards on the whole thing. And we're going to now just destroy it all very quickly. Okay, so hold on to your hats. We're going to go very quickly. So sin for David, it is murdering the husband of the woman he accidentally got pregnant after watching her in the shower. For Solomon, it is having 300 concubines. Which isn't quite enough for one day, one for each day of the year, so he also has 700 wives. But the trouble is, all of those people have their own gods. And Solomon is the temple builder, so he builds each of them a temple as well. And it is just like us and creation, that the kings, they stand between God and the people. So if the kings go wrong, they lead everybody off after them. And progressively, bit by bit, slowly, over hundreds of years, God judges and destroys the kingdom of Israel. God shows huge patience. There are opportunities for grace all along there. He warns them every step of the way, don't do this, don't do this. If you do this, it's all going to get destroyed. That is, by the way, the second job of prophets. Their job is to warn. So can we, I think there's something on the diagram. Let's go click. Okay, that wasn't what I was expecting, never mind. The job of prophets, oh, you know, Karen, keep going, there might be something else. No, go right to the end, keep going, go quickly, so we don't give any surprises, keep going. No, it's not there, okay, go back. It's on your handout on page 12. Page 12, we've got a timeline, and this may be the most useful thing about this whole weekend for your future Bible study reading. Take this diagram away, maybe photocopy it up so it's slightly bigger, and you can see on there where each of the prophets comes. Okay, so the name of each prophet in the Bible, it shows you where they fit in history. Because what the prophets are doing, you need to know who they're speaking to. It's very confusing, by the way. The nation of Israel, the word Israel, that means all of them when they're together. Once they split, it means just the northern bit, though they're sometimes called Ephraim. Then once we destroy the northern bit, sometimes we call the southern bit Israel as well. So that's confusing, isn't it? So you need to know which prophet is speaking to who and when. And the prophets are there to say, don't do it, don't get it, don't make such a big mistake, but they do. So let's go through. So Solomon's son is an idiot, and so the kingdom is divided in two. You have 10 tribes in the north, and only a tiny bit with two tribes that stick with the king in David's line, the king of the offspring, the eternal king. Then what happens is that every empire you could go and see in the British Museum comes and stamps on them, one by one by one. 200 years later, it is the king of Assyria who destroys the northern kingdom, which is the kind of left-hand line. That is the northern kingdom coming down, the lost 10 tribes of Israel. That's them. And Amos is a prophet who warns them, if you keep rebelling, you will be taken away with fish hooks. And there's an idea if you're babysitting, how do you want lots of people to do what you want? Just put a fish hook in each nose tie them to light, and then just pull. And you can get a whole nation to come with you across the deserts, and they're destroyed. Then 100 years later, the southern kingdom of Judah, they haven't learned, and twice in 597 BC and 587 BC, that's the second line, because the king of Babylon comes, and Jerusalem is destroyed, and the people are scattered. Worst of all, turn to 2 Kings, chapter 25, and we want to read from verses 4 to 7, if the next person would do that.
Let the breach of the city, and all the men of war, fled by night, by way of the gate, and the walls, by the king's army, through the house of Israel, who are the around the city. And they went in the direction of Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued him and overtook him in the place of Jericho, and all his army kept him from him. Then they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riphah, and they cast sentence from him. They slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and bound him in chains and took his down.
So the king and the sons. Well, how about the offspring? How about the crusher? It's a pretty final way to deal with the line of the kings. You kill all of the sons, and you make the king watch, and then you put his eyes out. So that's the last thing that he remembers and ever saw. Or 24 verse 13, we destroy the temple. Or 25 verse 9, we burn it down. So the house of the Lord and the city of Jerusalem is destroyed. So then there is no people because they're dead or in exile. There is no place because it's been destroyed. And there is no relationship because there is no temple, no sacrifice, and no offspring. Now, is that a total disaster? Has everything gone wrong? Well, no. Because remember, this is just the prototype. This is the copy, the shadow, the illustration of what was to come. And this was never meant to last forever. We're always meant to be looking ahead to what comes next. And that's exactly what happens. Here's the third role of a prophet, is to foretell the future. So just last slide. What the prophets say launches off what's happening, off the ski slope, if you like. Even as the kingdom is collapsing, the same prophets, as they warn them, they begin to make greater and greater claims about a future kingdom. Claims that go way beyond Solomon and his empire. Claims that go all the way up to the end. So just now, last slide. And what we're going to do, let's put it around the room again. So Zechariah 9, kind of here. Isaiah 65, kind of there. And Jeremiah 31, kind of there. And Isaiah 53, kind of here. And that is your homework. Okay, so by the time we meet again this afternoon, you can see on the sheets, there's a little bit of space just to write what is it that that prophet is promising. So just put a star next to the one that is you, and then we'll come back to that when we begin in the next session.